Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Traditionally, print publishers in the United States have been relegated to ancillary positions in art historical discussions concerning the production of multiples by artists and printers. Mason McClue traces the development of fine art publishing through his experience cataloging the American works on paper recently acquired from the Corcoran Gallery of Art, illuminating little-known yet influential figures who encouraged consumers to collect prints. In this lecture on November 5, 2018, as part of the Works in Progress lecture series at the National Gallery of Art, McClue discusses the rise of American print publishers in the art market from the Federalist era to the present by contextualizing significant examples from the Corcoran collection with other notable works in the gallery's permanent collection.
I'm going to start today with William Gropper's Senate. I selected this image because it felt pertinent given that many of us will be exercising our civic right tomorrow, but also because of the attitude embodied by Gropper's caricature. A sheet of gleaming white paper held aloft in his left hand, his right clenched passionately, mouth agape as he extols ideas with zeal. This posturing is how I imagine the best print publishers, ardent supporters of the graphic arts who fueled an appreciation for fine art prints by the general public and led to a burgeoning print market for American artists. I would like to argue that the success of fine art prints in the United States is not the result of artists freed from reproductive printmaking, or the result of printers heralding one new technique over another, but rather the result of publishers continually advancing art appreciation before the eyes of the public, priming them to become collectors and build great print collections. But this specific impression is what led me to dig deeper into American print publishers. As most of the prints acquired from the Corcoran Gallery of Art did not have publisher information listed in the collection database. As part of the cataloging process, I created a constituent record for Associated American Artists, the publisher of Gropper's prints. And as I was linking it to prints from the Corcoran collection, I realized that there were dozens of prints already in the permanent collection that were published by AAA and not identified as such. I found similar instances of incomplete records for other publishers going back to the 19th century, and suddenly this became a focus of my research. One of the earliest fine art print publishers in the United States actually self-published his own artworks. Charles B.J. Favre de Saint-Maman was a Frenchman from Dijon, a former military officer and member of the French hereditary nobility whose property and in fact livelihood were in jeopardy after the French Revolution. Immigrating to New York in 1793, he learned the art of engraving within 3 years, and by 1796 began advertising himself in the newspaper as a portraitist for hire. He traveled to cities up and down the East Coast, creating likenesses of some of the most prominent members of political and social life, such as these portraits of Meriwether Lewis and Thomas Jefferson. President Jefferson had engravings by Saint-Maman displayed on a shelf in his study and sat for the artist multiple times, often receiving requests from friends and family to send them an engraved likeness. When a sitter commissioned Saint-Maman to produce a portrait, the artist delivered a finished pastel and charcoal drawing, a dozen engravings, and the original copper plate, keeping several proof impressions for himself. According to one of Saint-Maman's advertisements, quote, "The original portrait, plate, and 12 impressions shall be delivered for the moderate price of $25 for gentlemen and $35 for ladies. The portrait without engravings may be had for $5. I guess elaborate hairstyles and fancy lace dresses came with a premium in the eyes of the artist. To create his profile portraits, Saint-Maman used a device called a physionotrace, likely very similar to the one in this diagram created by Rembrandt Peale. The sitter would be seated so that the ear lined up with the little paddle near the bottom, marked with a capital D, and as their contours were traced, the corresponding profile would be created on a sheet of paper mounted near the top, marked with a lowercase d. After Saint-Maman returned to France in 1814, he organized the extra proof impressions remaining in his possession and directed an assistant to assemble one set in a large oblong folio. Following the artist's subscription list, each sitter's name was recorded below the trimmed engraving. Although the original volume is no longer bound, each page or group retains the original paperboard backing upon which are mounted 3 rows of 5 engravings. These impressions are part of the largest collection of engravings by Saint-Maman, often referred to as the master set, since it contains 818 unique portraits. After the artist died, the set was inherited by his nephew, who sold it to the British dealer Henry Stevens. He brought the set back to the United States around 1874 and tried to interest the Library of Congress in purchasing the engravings. But they instead referred Stevens to a man who at the time was building a new art gallery adjacent to the White House and might be interested in purchasing the set. That man was William Wilson Corcoran, and his purchase became some of the first artworks to enter the collection of the Corcoran Gallery of Art. Sam Amen's story of self-publishing a massive portrait project is similar to another artist of the early 19th century, John James Audubon. When trying to secure a publisher for his ornithological venture, The Birds of America, he was turned away by everyone he visited in Boston, New York, and Philadelphia. The costs seemed unfathomable to those he approached, but Audubon eventually decided to publish his series of 435 prints completely on his own, even selling his wife's collection of family silver when they fell into debt. Audubon traveled to Scotland in part to exhibit his drawings and solicit subscriptions from wealthy armchair ornithologists, but also to obtain the services of a skilled printer who could create elephant folio-sized images, the choices of which were lacking in the United States. Audubon met William Lizars, who he thought had the skill to translate his detailed drawings into prints. But Lizars had produced only the first 10 plates for Audubon, this one of the wild turkey being the first, before the artist decided the quality and coloring was inadequate and he would need to find another engraver. Audubon found a suitable replacement in London with master printmaker Robert Havell Jr., who reworked the first 10 plates before continuing with the rest of the series. Havell employed teams of women to hand color the prints in an assembly line fashion, and birds of prey like these peregrine falcons were often a favorite to paint, where unnamed artists were free to embellish the blood and gore, leading to not so subtle variations throughout the edition. Subscribers received the series in a group of 5 prints, with each delivery containing one large bird, one medium-sized bird, and 3 small birds. The subscription model is still used by certain print publishers today, but the American Art Union, founded in 1839, had a novel approach to the idea. Each year, the organization purchased more than 100 paintings from the most prominent American artists and would choose from exhibition the most crowd-pleasing examples to engrave and publish. Such was the case with Thomas Cole's wildly popular Voyage of Life series, which was acquired by the Art Union in 1849. Now, I would like to note that I'm referring to the original set of paintings now owned by the Munson Williams Proctor Institute, not the second set on display upstairs. The Art Union selected Cole's panel, Voyage of Life, Youth, to be turned into an engraving for their members, but much like Audubon's experience, they could not find an American engraver who was up to the task of creating this reproductive print, and instead turned to a Scottish immigrant named James Smillie. As an additional perk to subscribers who received this print in 1850, they were entered into a year-end lottery to win one of the original oil paintings in the Art Union's collection. It was this lottery that drew the attention of New York State authorities, who accused the organization of promoting the illicit activity of gambling. The illegality of the Art Union's lottery led to the downfall of the organization in 1851, after they had published only 36 engravings. Up to this point, we have looked primarily at engravings printed from copper plates, but we'll now look at lithographs pulled from stones that are drawn on with a greasy crayon or liquid, exploiting the repellent properties of oil and water. Lithography was discovered in 1796 by Alois Senefelder in Bavaria, so it makes sense that some of the earliest lithographic firms were operated by German immigrants such as Julius Bien in New York, who undertook a failed project to reproduce Audubon's Birds of America in lithography. Perhaps the most famous lithographic publisher during the 19th century, though, was Currier and Ives, who produced over 7,000 prints during their existence from 1835 to 1907, such as this one of the City of Washington. Nathaniel Currier began his lithographic career like many others at the time, taking jobs to print sheet music, business letterheads, and certificates for fraternal organizations, but he was eventually joined by his brother-in-law, James Merritt Ives, and they decided to become independent publishers who would no longer take outside work, but instead specialize in creating original, inexpensive prints to decorate American homes. As new artists entered the firm, Currier gradually shifted into a management role, allowing younger artists to begin to put their mark on the company. Louis Maurer became a specialist in the anatomy of trotting horses. Francis Flora Bond Palmer was known for still lifes and engaging rural views. Charles Parsons focused on the details of naval ships, and Thomas Worth produced spirited comedic prints. The firm created scenes of noteworthy events and news, but also produced large-scale views of cities like the one behind me, which is currently undergoing major conservation to remove the sheet from the mount to which it was adhered. The range of American scenes published by Currier and Ives is unsurpassed until the 20th century. It is in the last two decades of the 19th century, though, when an etching revival began to take hold, and one of the foremost champions of American etchers was Sylvester Rosa Kohler, the first print curator at the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston. He was the editor of the short-lived American Art Review, which ran for only 2 years from 1879 to 1881, and is known for bringing prominence to American etchers. Although officially published by Estes and Laureate, Kohler was the driving force behind the publication. Indicative of this movement is Up the Hill by James David Smillie, whose father engraved Thomas Cole's Voyage of Life. This etching would have been one of two or three that were tipped into an issue, each accompanying an article or a short description about the artist. Kohler corresponded with each selected artist, obtaining a finished etched plate to be printed by American Art Review, meaning none of the impressions were actually signed by the artists, something almost considered unthinkable in the 20th century. Besides picturesque landscapes, Kohler also commissioned reproductive etchings in the manner of the American Art Union, such as this image by William Unger. Unger painstakingly etched the portrait of Cincinnati artist Frank Duveneck after the original by William Merritt Chase, thereby allowing Kohler to illustrate articles on painters as well as etchers. American Art Review is also notable for the prominence of female artists such as Mary Nemo Moran and Eliza Pratt Greatorex, who brought a European sensibility to the movement. What is so interesting about this collection of etching proofs, though, is that many of them still retain their original supports, where the print is adhered with a thin line of paste at the top and has a handwritten caption below the impression. Kohler likely used these proofs while laying out the various issues, and then after American Art Review was discontinued in 1881, donated the entire set to Corcoran's new gallery. Kohler retained the original plates, though, and continued to pull impressions for his subsequent books on American etching, which were published by Estes and Laureate throughout the remainder of the decade. Thomas Moran was possibly the most famous artist Kohler solicited for inclusion in his publications, but it is a small blind stamp in the margin of Moran's Mountain of the Holy Cross, Colorado, that brought forth a publishing puzzle. The stamp has the letters AAU in the middle, which were presumed to refer to the American Art Union, with the words Society of American Etchers around the edge, but the two organizations existed decades apart. The American Art Union was disbanded by 1851, before being revived for a short period in the early 1880s, again getting into trouble with New York State over their illegal lottery. The Society of American Etchers, on the other hand, was not started until 1931. An October 1888 article in Frank Leslie's Sunday Magazine shed light on this matter, and I quote, "The leading American etchers have formed a society having for its objects, first, the elevation of the art of etching in this country, and secondly, the limitation of editions, each publication by the members of the society being guaranteed by the stamp of the Society of American Etchers, in the same way as English prints are protected by the print seller's stamp." It appears that this small group of etchers, led by Moran, were trying to resuscitate the aspirations of the AAU into a new organization called the Society of American Etchers, an endeavor that apparently dissolved after a couple of years. One reason the society may not have gained much traction is because all of its members were already part of the larger New York Etching Club, making stamped impressions such as this exceedingly rare. As we enter the 20th century, we find many artists who produce prints in differing mediums depending on the print society publishing the impression. Thomas Nason engraved The Approach of Spring on a copper plate for the Society of American Etchers, mentioned previously. Using similar tools, Nason engraved the hard end grain of a woodblock to create Upland Pastures, Vermont for the Woodcut Society. Started by Alfred Fowler in 1932, the Woodcut Society printed all of their presentation prints at Torch Press in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, helping to spread print societies to far-flung locales. Fowler was an active member of the United States Air Force while running the society, and his movements from Kansas City, Missouri, to Cedar Rapids, to Alexandria, Virginia, and finally to Hicksville, New York, led many to think there were multiple woodcut societies when there was truly only one. Some societies changed their names numerous times over the years, as was the case with the Brooklyn Society of Etchers, established in 1915. By 1931, they had apparently outgrown the limitations of their New York borough and changed their name to the Society of American Etchers. After World War II, they changed their name again to the more inclusive Society of American Etchers, Gravers, Lithographers, and Woodcutters, before finally settling on the umbrella term Society of American Graphic Artists in 1952. Some of their greatest prints were created by Martin Lewis, such as this Dry Point Chance Meeting. The image does not do justice to the velvety rich tones that Lewis pulled out of the shadows, but the attraction of the man and woman is obvious from their postures, where their pelvises are almost drawn to each other by magnetic force. You'll also notice from the credit line that established institutions such as the Corcoran Gallery of Art were actively subscribing to these print publishing societies, but also new museums in order to actively build their nascent graphic arts collections with prints by contemporary artists. One of the more unexpected publishers of the 20th century was the United States government through the auspices of the Federal Art Project, a small part of the overarching New Deal started by President Roosevelt. Many prominent artists found work with the FAP, which was not a form of outright relief, but rather a way to allow artists to earn a living while practicing their craft. Prints such as Silence by Mabel Dwight would have been pulled in very small editions of sometimes no more than 25 impressions before the stones were reground for another artist. The prints were then gathered into federally sponsored exhibitions that toured venues of public buildings, such as libraries and schools. On the other end of the spectrum is the private publisher Associated American Artists, which I mentioned at the beginning of the lecture. Founded in 1934 by Reeves Lewenthal in the Manhattan studio of Thomas Hart Benton, AAA's goal was to stimulate wider public interest in the ownership of fine works of art, but they are primarily remembered as the organization that brought the $5 mail order print to the American public. An avid supporter of the American scene, Lewenthal helped bring greater fame to the triumvirate of regionalists, Benton, John Stuart Curry, and Grant Wood. Benton popularized rural scenes of Middle America, such as Slow Train Through Arkansas, and his appreciation for El Greco is evident in the contorted figure of the man trying to herd cattle off the tracks. The dynamic composition almost seems to pulse and sway as if the landscape is responding to the actions of man and beast. Curry, on the other hand, presents a circus scene that would have been familiar to members of the public in the 1930s, making the print quite saleable. The shackle attached to the tent pole in the foreground alludes to the other job for elephants at the circus, as heavy lifters who raised the big top before the show and brought it down afterward. It is literally an image of a bygone era, though, as the largest traveling show in America, the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, retired all of their elephants when they closed in 2017. The man famously known for painting American Gothic, Grant Wood was one of the most popular artists at AAA. When his first lithographs weren't ready in time to be illustrated in the catalog, they were listed as text entries only, yet his enduring popularity with the public caused Wood's editions to sell out sight unseen. In Fertility, one can see a house very similar to that depicted in the painting, featuring a prominent second-story Gothic window. I might argue that in this innocuous scene, the couple have been replaced by gendered proxies in the phallic form of the silo and a barn whose details mimic female anatomy. Wood sparked outright controversy with the United States Postal Service over the overt display of sexuality in his print Sultry Night. Featuring a nude male farmer washing off next to a horse trough at the end of the day, the print was deemed obscene and not allowed to be sold through the mail. As a result, only 100 impressions were ever pulled, and for the next 20 years could only be purchased in person at the AAA Gallery. AAA expanded the meaning of American when it began associations with Mexican artists such as Alfredo Zaus. In Henequen Plant in Yucatan, the artist focused on laborers in the southern portion of the country processing the leaves of henequen plants, a species of agave, into fibers that can be seen heaped in the distance. The fibers are then woven to produce a low-quality twine that is used on farms for things such as baling hay. Much as AAA latched onto the quote-unquote common imagery of the regionalists and raised it to a fine art, they sought to elevate the prints of Mexican artists as well. One of my favorite artists from AAA's stable is Norma Morgan, an African-American artist who spent much of her time traveling through the moors of Scotland. Middledene Farm almost certainly relates to her travels, but it is the textures that she achieves through a mixture of engraving elaborate patterns and using aquatint to create a range of tones that give her work such an identifiable look. AAA managed to keep their publishing business open almost as long as Currier Knives, finally closing their doors in the year 2000. As Morgan was completing this print in 1958, though, a new wave of publishers began to emerge in the United States. Tatiana Grossman started Universal Limited Art Editions in 1957 at her small summer cottage in West Islip, New York. Her husband, Maurice, was an unsuccessful reproductive screen printer who had recently had a heart attack, leaving Grossman to care for the family. She began bringing contemporary artists out from New York to her studio, first meeting Robert Rauschenberg after he offered to help Grossman carry lithographic stones up to Jasper John's studio in the same building. Rauschenberg apparently quipped after schlepping the stones, "I didn't know modern art was that heavy." Grossman produced a couple of small prints with Rauschenberg, but as he was starting his third print, a crack developed in the stone that caused it to fracture. Always one to embrace chance in his work, Rauschenberg subsequently made the decision to continue printing the edition with a broken stone, something completely unheard of up until that time. Titled Accident, Grossman submitted this work to the 5th Exposition Internationale de Gravure in Yugoslavia, where it won the grand prize, widely considered at the time to be the most prestigious award in the world, bringing critical acclaim to both Rauschenberg and ULAE. Grossman continued to support artists who were pushing the boundaries of convention, finding ways to execute each artist's vision with fastidiousness. Lee Bontekou, in her study for Untitled Print, inverts the typical relationship of image to sheet, using white ink on black paper, which gives the feel of moonlight on a rippling ocean at night. Grossman even helped R. Buckminster Fuller take the book to an entirely new level with his Tetra Scroll. The lithographs are mounted on equilateral, triangular-shaped boards that are bound with sailcloth on alternating sides, allowing the viewer to unfurl the book into a variety of configurations. At the top is the artist seated with his Tetra Scroll during a gallery exhibition in New York. Each book came in its own handmade wooden box, which was numbered and stamped with the ULAE symbol, as you see pictured in storage when I was opening it for cataloging. The combined weight of the book and box is probably well over 80 pounds, making it an extremely strange object to manipulate. On the West Coast, June Wayne received a grant from the Ford Foundation in 1960 to establish the Tamarind Lithography Workshop in Los Angeles. Wayne's idea was that they would restore the art of lithography in the United States by providing professional training to printmakers in order to prepare them for collaborating directly with artists. They took for their logo the alchemical symbol for stone, seen here on the dies that produce the embossed chop mark at the bottom of each published impression. Master printmaker Kenneth Tyler began his career at Tamarind, where he was technical director until 1965 when he left to form Gemini Limited, or Gemini LTD. Tyler operated Gemini for a year until he was joined by Sidney Felsen, a certified public accountant, and Stanley Grinstein, the owner of a local forklift business. Both men took art classes in their free time and began to associate with many artists in the Los Angeles area, and on the business side, brought much-needed skills to the venture that was shortly renamed Gemini Graphic Editions Limited, or Gemini GEL. I began to understand the difference between the two iterations with this lithograph by George Rickey. The Gemini chop mark, found in the lower right corner of the sheet, never changed over the years, but I was unable to find this print in any documentation about Gemini GEL, including the publisher's online catalog raisonné produced by the National Gallery of Art. I called Sidney Felsen to inquire about this undocumented print, and he informed me that the impression must have been pulled by Tyler in 1965 when he was the sole proprietor of Gemini LTD. Tyler departed from the publisher in 1973 and took with him any documentation about the prints produced during that first year. Because of the contentious nature of Tyler's departure, any prints created prior to the formation of Gemini GEL are not considered part of their oeuvre, even though they carry the Gemini chop. Tyler moved to the East Coast in 1974 and started Tyler Graphics Limited, which was known for producing large, complex prints such as Reflections on the Screen by Roy Lichtenstein, which some of you may recognize from the Sense of Humor exhibition on display here on the ground floor. Tyler masterfully blends lithography, screen printing, and woodcuts with embossing and collage, a far leap from the strict adherence to a single medium practiced by artists in the 19th and earlier part of the 20th century. Gemini benefited from their close proximity to Tamarind in Los Angeles, attracting new, highly skilled printers from June Wayne's workshop who wanted to continue Tyler's legacy at Gemini. And the publisher continued to push the boundaries of printmaking with their edition multiples, such as Klaus Oldenburg's Geometric Mouse. The sculptural multiple was released in 4 scales, with the larger 3 constructed primarily of anodized aluminum. The smallest version, scale D, can be seen here still shrink-wrapped in its original packaging with the base and supporting documentation. This iteration reproduces the artist's handwritten notations of size, parts, and intended display position for the mouse head. With an example like this, it is clear the print has become an object to be played with, just as much as one to be displayed on the wall or in a vitrine. Even cutting-edge New York galleries such as Pace decided to enter the publishing business in the 1970s. Run by Arnie Glimcher, known as the person who convinced Rauschenberg to donate his erased de Kooning drawing to the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, Pace had a particularly strong relationship with Louise Nevelson, with Glimcher himself writing numerous essays about the artist. Pace Editions published six of Nevelson's lead intaglio reliefs, which were created at Sergio and Fausta Tosi's workshop in Milan, Italy. Nevelson created small wood assemblages in much the same way as her larger sculptures, which were then mounted on a support board. Each section was covered with a thin sheet of lead and then run through a press, and likely worked by hand as well, creating an embossed design. With artwork such as this, the canon of what is considered a printed multiple has expanded greatly since the beginning of the 19th century. Although Tyler Graphics is now defunct, Gemini, ULAE, and Pace continue to produce new editions to this day. Tamarin relocated to Albuquerque and is now part of the University of New Mexico. Other publishing houses such as Graphic Studio in Florida and Crown Point Press in San Francisco ensure artists continue to have access to skilled workshops capable of carrying out the most demanding and ambitious print projects. The success of these print publishers is thanks to multifaceted approaches that have been continuously experimented with and improved upon over generations in the United States, connecting artists with printers and the collecting public with fine prints by their favorite artists. And in my opinion, the only way to tell the story of American print publishing is through the Corcoran Collection at the National Gallery of Art. Thank you. Free to take any questions, if anyone has any. Yes, Diana.
Thanks, and that's great. I was wondering, predictably, about the financial arrangements of all of this, because it's obviously pretty expensive to be running a workshop, and if they publish it, how much revenue from selling these impressions does the publisher get versus the artist, versus the master printer, let's say?
I don't have financial breakdowns like that, but I can tell you across these, like Audubon's was a losing venture. Like, it didn't make any money, you know, and I would say Saint Amand probably made a moderate amount based on these $25 and these $35 commissions. But I venture not to guess on some of these contemporary publishing houses because, I mean, these prints are going for six figures sometimes, and I'm sure the publisher's probably taking a large portion of that, given the overhead and everything that needs to be done. I wish I had more details, but you know, that's more your specialty than mine. Yes?
How systematic was the Corcoran's collecting policy? Were they trying to collect all of these to represent this genre?
I would say it was not systematic at all. I think with lots of collections, they're kind of built with fits and stops, and a lot of what enters a collection might have to do with, you know, the collectors that you're courting. And I mean, I think with the case of some of these print societies from the early 20th century, as they subscribe to the presentation prints, they might have a very accurate representation of what was produced by, say, the Woodcut Society. But an organization like Associated American Artists would have produced well over 1,000 prints. And it just seems like too much. I mean, even the best print collectors don't seem to have an entire representation of a publisher like that, or Courier Knives that produced 7,000 prints. I mean, that's a monumental task. It would take a lifetime of collecting to put all that together. But what the Corcoran really did is try to get very choice select examples that would allow me to tell a story like this, you know, so you really get a full range, breadth, not depth. Yes?
I think I have actually two questions, but I'm kind of curious about the size runs of some of these issues. Mm-hmm. And I know, I guess the second part is, I know during the War Projects Administration, there was a greater emphasis in America on creating a multiple image rather than just a definitive singular work of art. But coming down into the 1960s with African American art particularly, do you see that in the Corcoran collection, that they had to focus, or any interest in collecting African-American multiples?
I think one of the big cases is, if you're familiar with the work of Lou Stovall, who's run the, printmaking workshop. I can't remember the exact title of here in DC, but he's produced, you know, prints for Jacob Lawrence. He's in the process of actually putting together an archive and a catalog now, and it'll be really interesting to kind of see what kind of gems are unearthed from the drawers of his studio. But that's just the one that jumps out to me right away.
Yeah, but nothing really from the Corcoran's collection. I know they...
Well, the Corcoran collected quite a bit. I mean, I think we have at least 10 prints from Lou Stovall. We've got some of the major Jacob Lawrence prints that he produced. And Associated American Artists had quite a few African American artists working for them as well. But as I said from the previous question, Corcoran wasn't really systematic in collecting, especially from Associated American Artists. AAA kind of, you know, it fell out of favor as abstract expressionism rose in the 50s and 60s. And it really wasn't, I guess, until the 80s that kind of this appreciation for the artists associated with AAA kind of regained their former stature. So. Yes.
Are you anticipating putting together any kind of an exhibition?
I am not at this time. But I'm always open to it.
Gallery owned and some of the highlights of it?
I think that would be great. I think at some point we will be having exhibition space in the Corcoran Gallery of Art's historic building, and that might be a great opportunity to do something like this, but I mean, these are on the horizon, yeah. Yes.
One further question. So, you may have sort of addressed it already, but are there the resources for scholars, collectors, to do research on what artists participated in these various workshops, or like a master directory of printmakers or something?
Wow, that would be incredible. I'm sure, there's got to be professional societies that have the makings of these types of lists that you're referring to. But really, you want to look for catalogs, raisonnés that publishers have tried to put out themselves. So with Tamarind or with Gemini, those are kind of the go-to sources. And like with Lou Stovall, if that actually is put online, you know, those are the types of resources that you would start with, I would say. And that seems to be the big shift coming online. You know, you used to have to schlep to the library and dig out big, heavy, multi-volume works, and now with the click of a mouse, you can do it at home, so.
I would like to just add that Mason has gotten all of the Corcoran works on paper, online, and we have imaged them so you can see them now. So a huge task has been taken care of so you know what's there. So if you go to nga.gov, take a look at some of the artists or search the Corcoran credit line.
Yeah, and if you searched Corcoran credit line and you pull up any of the records, we've been as thorough as we can, and there'll be bibliographic references attached to those works that'll direct you to catalogs. There'll be exhibition references that'll direct you to exhibition catalogs. And provenance will tell you a lot about how we acquired it, who owned it, who was building these collections. And those are three things that you can find online with every Corcoran work that has been cataloged.
Do you have it listed by like print shop?
Oh, you can. You can search by print shop. That's what I talked about briefly at the beginning. We have a collections database, and we have constituent records for each artist. And part of what I've been trying to do is make sure we have as complete as possible publishing records for these publishing houses. And so you should be able to go onto the NGA website, search Associated American Artists, and it will bring up everything from the collection that was published by them. We're still working on it with Gemini and some of the other ones. The collections are just so big, it takes time. But it was easier with some of these smaller ones.
That's great work.
Thank you. Hey, Sarah.
Follow up on the person's question that so many of the resources that you probably published on our website would be available in the National Gallery of Art Library, which is open to the public by appointment.
Thank you.
Just occurred to me.
Yeah. Yeah, we have great facilities here, great research facilities.
Thank you.
I encourage you all to use them. And come visit us in the Department of American Modern Prints and Drawings. We'd be happy to pull out any of the things you saw today or anything your hearts desire. We're here. It's your collection, just as well as ours. All right, well, thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.